Warning, Klingon, tractor beam engaged.
Captain Lorca was captured.
We will find him.
Where are we?
A Klingon prison vessel.
Prepare to jump.
I don't know how much more the creature can sustain.
I gave you an order.
You seek glory.
But glory must be earned through sacrifice.
Stick with me. I'm a survivor, just like you.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, swallowing the urge to set the record straight.
And we have a very special guest this week, training bugs to collect intel from his enemies, Jesse Okendo.
How you doing, guys?
Hey, great to have you back on the show. Jesse, you've been on before, but it's great that we can actually have you on to discuss the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, Choose Your Pain.
Jesse, I'd like you to choose your pain right now.
Yeah, point at one of us, Cam or Tyler. Jesse, for listeners there, Jesse did not hesitate. He pointed directly at me. There's no hesitation.
The listener's choice.
Yeah.
It's been a great weekend, folks.
So guys, what we're going to do, what we've been doing for the last few weeks with Star Trek Discovery is we're tying it back to a previous podcast episode, previous themes that we've explored. And what we want to do is characters who must suffer, because I think we see some examples of characters who are suffering just a little bit in this episode, guys.
Yeah, Tilly.
I agree.
Tilly, yes. Yeah. No, what about Burnham with the snoring that she's dealing with?
I think let's dive deep into that snoring.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
think that's, you know, where the topic is today.
But I think it's also worth bringing up, just for people tuning in, you may notice a little bit difference in the sound quality. We are actually on the road. We're in San Francisco for the Continuing Voyage Star Trek convention. We got to chat with a whole bunch of actors. It was a fun weekend. Maybe we can give a few details and a bit of a wrap-up at the end of this episode.
But cool.
Yeah, so just be prepared and... guys, why don't we just jump into it if we want to tie this into characters who must suffer. Cam, what's on your mind right now?
Well, I mean, when we did this episode originally, you know, the big poster boy of it was O'Brien.
Yes.
Because how many episodes of Deep Space Nine was O'Brien suffering, right? So, you know, this is an episode where we see a lot of characters suffer. We see, you know, Lorca being kidnapped and suffering. We're introduced to Ash Tyler, Lieutenant Ash Tyler, and seeing him getting beaten up a lot in prison. We also see the tardigrade going through this horrible process of what the spork drive does to it. And Burnham is suffering, at least internally, as, you know, what to do. And Samet!
Yeah.
Or, so there's a whole lot of suffering in this episode.
Even think about Saru. He's got to deal with this crew that maybe is questioning him all the time.
Yeah, a lot of characters on the Discovery are suffering.
Even Dr. Hugh Culber has to deal with like a partner who just really likes to troll him pretty much.
Yeah.
So I like to think this is a very tortured crew at this point.
Yeah, they really are, and we're only five episodes in.
But why don't we maybe take it character by character? We've got Lorca. We're introduced at one point to a scene where he's literally injecting his eyes with I don't know exactly what he's doing with his
eyes.
I'm
just gonna assume it's something to like maintain their current level or something.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
It's sort of maintenance on the old beepers.
Yeah, but after a while, look, he's got the eye claw like going at him. I think we've seen similar devices in other film TV shows, and he's also going, because I have to believe this is essentially the Klingon's way of like shining bright shiny objects into a guy who can't really handle it, which
Definitely.
Is intriguing there. Guys, what about this Ash Tyler fella? Because I think he's been in the main credits for five episodes now.
Yeah.
We finally meet him. What are our first impressions of Ash Tyler? Jesse, what do you think of Ash Tyler?
I'm a little bit surprised that there was a survivor from the battle at the Binary Stars.
Yeah, why are the Klingons taking people prisoner at this point? Hey, especially since the Federation apparently left Voke's ship just adrift, how come the Federation's not taking prisoners either?
I'm very confused by that whole thing.
Let me just say, Ash Tyler looked way too good
yes.
to have been there for like 7 months.
Yeah.
Like, look, Shahzad Latif, he's an attractive man. So, and he still looked attractive after 7 weeks.
But maybe he was even more attractive, and like this is him looking really ugly. He's just like a specimen of humanity prior to this. Just imagine what he used to look like.
People, we look like tardigrades.
Yeah. But, okay, it's fascinating because this is obviously a guy who's been a prisoner of war for 7 months.
Yeah.
It's implied that he's being raped by the Klingon leader here aboard the ship. I was very confused. That I was like, is this supposed to be Laurel?
I was wondering the same thing. I had to go through the credits after the episode.
But it's not Laurel, even though Mary Chifo is credited in this episode. And yeah. I was very confused because she said she's descended from a house of liars, or spies.
Spies, yeah.
Which is also what Laurel is descended from. So they're relatives?
Maybe?
Yeah, I'm kind of...
I believe we're going to see this character again because the episode ends with her getting scars on her face, more suffering.
Yes, that's true.
And you don't scar a character and leave them screaming on the ground if that's not going to pay off later down the road.
But can you explain that? Kill, 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 evaporate, evaporate, evaporate.
Yeah,
let's leave a scar on your cheek.
No, why did Lorca just leave her? Like, does he want to leave? Is it very much like what he did not want to happen to his crew, where they're brought back to Kronos, they're left to suffer and get tortured in a way? That's why he destroyed his own ship and his crew.
Yeah.
Maybe he wants to induce fear with the Klingons. Like, hey, this is what a crazy man like Lorca is going to be willing to do to you guys.
I feel like that moment needed an extra beat or something, just to give us a sense of whether this was, as you know, as we initially maybe implied, like just a weird moment of not killing her versus an intentional move by Lorca. Like, I would have liked something, just a little bit of something, you know, just to give it a little more depth.
But she is coming back, right?
Yeah.
Will we get a Harry prison captain team-up episode? Harry promised that he was going to be coming back soon, right?
Yeah.
And I was kind of wondering that when I saw it. I went, okay, so he's, you know, vowing revenge.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to remember my Harry Mudd episode. So I don't think that it matters at this point.
No.
But so he left her alive.
Yeah.
And was it so that someone can find Harry Mudd, because he didn't kill Harry Mudd? I mean, that's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. Like, I mean, I think we can just say, like, this episode raised a lot more questions.
Yes. Many loose threads that I'll get tied up soon.
Yeah.
But if we're on the topic of Harry Mudd, can we just address this right out of the gate here?
Yeah,
with
sure.
Regards to his appearance. Jesse, I'm just curious, going into this, did you have any real strong feelings one way or another towards Harry Mudd?
No, because I feel the same way that I did going in, which is, I don't know if this is the Harry Mudd I know.
Yeah.
And like, now I don't know.
It's an interesting point. Like, did you know, you'd seen all the original series episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Harry Mudd ones stand out to you as, like, episodes that you liked more than, say, others?
No, they were just funny. Like, kind of funny.
Right.
They were...
like, silly.
Yeah, like comic relief, you know. I wouldn't expect to see Harry Mudd, this type of Harry Mudd. I don't link him to...
like a tortured, suffering, scorpion owner of a guy.
Right.
Well, I accept that he's not ethical and he's only looking out for himself, because that theme is the same. But the whole evil gonna come get you and kill you vibe he was giving, that didn't...
didn't vibe with the Harry Mudd we were mm-hmm. originally introduced to. Yeah. I'll give you guys just a Cliff Notes version of my issue with Harry Mudd. Is back in the 1960s, this guy was a sex trafficker, and he was portrayed as kind of a rascally sort of scoundrel that just kind of, as you say, Jesse, played for laughs. But you bring back a sex trafficker into modern era, and he's still being played as kind of this rascally sort of character, without really acknowledging that this guy is a very, very problematic character that's from an entirely different era. Whether or not he's into sex trafficking now, you're going to be playing with a guy with a certain amount of reverence that I don't think is warranted in this case. And I think the writers should have just left this guy forgotten about.
It was interesting because, you know, when we saw trailers showing glimpses of Harry Mudd, I said... at the time on the podcast, like, this does not look like any Harry Mudd I know.
Right.
I will say, watching the episode, it felt like Harry Mudd to me. Like, it felt like you take the Harry Mudd of those comedy episodes, drop them in a serious episode, like a dark, serious wartime episode, I can see that Harry Mudd being the sort of cockroach who will do anything to survive over someone else. It's almost like, you know, look at Koloth in The Trouble with Tribbles, right? And then look at him in his DS9 episode. And you can see how that character is the same character, but we're seeing it in a different tone. It's you know, as you said, Tyler, it's the issue of, like, Harry Mudd, he's not a character that we've seen a lot of depth with. And so, I don't know. Like, I don't know where I stand because I don't know where this character is going. I will say, like, I really enjoyed the language of the character. Like, I really enjoyed the way his dialogue was written and how it was played opposite, you know, like Lorca or Tyler. Like, it felt different, you know?
Like, he felt of this universe as well?
Yeah. Yeah, and he just felt, like, strange in a way. He felt, in a way, the most alien character in the episode. Because he feels like he almost stands outside of the action as sort of this commenter who's just... It just feels very devious, almost like a trickster character, like a Loki. And I don't mean like Thor Loki, who's, you know, just trying to take down his brother. I mean more like the mythical Loki or an Iago in Shakespeare character.
But, the one thing that I thought about Harry Mudd as I'm watching this is we have to remember it's not the sex trafficker yet, or we don't know if he is.
Right.
Yet. But there's a shade of gray here that he's playing. And like, I don't know, did we all catch that he's got this woman he's in love with and he's trying to get back to her? And so, like, it's that line again that I've seen in these episodes, which is, you know, this may not be the law, but this is the right thing to do. And is this Harry Mudd doing the right thing to do?
But there's also the question, is he telling the truth? Like, is Harry Mudd ever telling the truth?
Well, there is that.
Yeah. The other issue that I have, though, is he introduces himself, his crime was loving too much.
Right.
This is a guy who we know in this universe as a sex trafficker, and they're already saying, oh, that's just that little love dog you.
But he's just being facetious to me. It doesn't even sound like it's, like, honest. Like, no one talks like that if they're being honest. It seems like everything about him is deceit.
But no, I'm thinking it more on how the writers are approaching this guy. Right. I don't think they have the awareness of just how problematic this character is, though.
Well, I think they understand who he is as a person.
Like, sure.
They are writing to that. It's more the idea... And here's the thing. I don't know if other people acknowledge the baggage of this character as much as, like, obviously you do. You know what I mean?
Like, I just don't think people are aware of it. Like, they don't even really think about it. It's just kind of like, oh, hey, it's a rascally character who liked to sell women to very lonely minors for sexual favors.
Well, that's the thing, right? So you get that from him, and you get that from the original episodes that he was in, and I get where you're coming from. But most of the people who think of Harry Mudd think of a jokester, trickster, and think, oh, that's the 60s. That's just the way they did it then.
And I will say, I like the idea of Harry Mudd in the sense, like, in the original series, I like the idea of dropping a character like him who's just unpredictable and does not follow anything approaching Starfleet rules. It's kind of like a Rasmussen in Next Generation, right? You know, the Matt Frewer character. I like the idea of dropping characters like that with, you know, say, like, Kirk and crew, because it kind of upsets the balance. And it never worked in the original series very well. I don't think Harry Mudd worked very well in his episodes, and I don't think, like, the space hippies worked when you drop them in there either. It's like, it never quite worked, but I always kind of appreciated what they were trying to do, and I think TNG did it better, and other series, Deep Space Nine.
But can we bring up, I think, maybe the most important part that he brings to this? Look, I can rag on the decision to bring back this character all I want. He's here now. We'll deal with it. But he is saying, look, you Starfleet people, you think of yourselves way up above, and you don't ever consider the people down below. And I think this is kind of a worldview that we don't hear so much when it comes to the Federation. I think they touched on that with Deep Space Nine every once in a while. I think it is good that they are acknowledging that. We do have that kind of civilian aspect here that he is bringing. What do you think about what he's saying, guys? Jesse?
There's a callback here when he says that, and it's back to Enterprise right after the Zindi, where they go back and Phlox is in that bar, and they're like, you know, you people tell everybody where we're at and, you know, what we're doing and where to find us. And that, I got that vibe right away from that, which is, are they going on the, we're not quite as, all our humans on Earth aren't quite very happy that we're out here yet. And that's what I kind of threw myself back to.
Yeah, and what I liked about the way they're approaching that sort of theme through this character is that I don't know that there's a character I would describe as more low class in the Star Trek universe than someone like Harry Mudd. Who, like, every time we meet him in the original series, he has nothing.
Right.
He's just always struggling. And so it's a guy who's a perpetual screw-up, does not have any of sort of the comfort or luxury that we would see with, like, Starfleet or the Federation. And, I mean, I think a lot of that is self-chosen. He has terrible morals and would never exist within that world. But to see someone who can't exist within that world just constantly struggling and being like, you know, you guys are making it harder for people like me to operate. I think that's an interesting idea. I don't know that Discovery is going to dig really deep into that.
Right.
But I like the idea of it.
What about the other points that he's bringing up here about how he understands the Klingons' point of view? And I think it's good that we do have some humans that are acknowledging why the Klingons may want to go to war with the Federation. It does kind of bug me that they are conflating Starfleet with the Federation, which are two different things. But Harry Mudd is essentially saying, Starfleet, you keep going up to the front door of these powerful empires or what have you. Aren't you thinking that they're eventually going to push back at this?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I like that we have someone, kind of backing the Klingons or saying, like, look, it's not, black and white in this war. I wish the show, though, had done a little more to make the Klingons look a little more sympathetic. I think that's actually maybe a flaw so far in this story, in that they'd said kind of from the start, people were like, kind of not crazy about how much they were looking to demonize the Klingons, giving them a much uglier look, essentially. But
What about last week's episode? Like, when we spent so much time with Volk and Laurel?
I think they make, like, a character like Volk a little more sympathetic, but then you have, like, Call coming in, and he doesn't look so sympathetic. And, I know, like, some of our listeners probably are really into the game Warcraft. And Warcraft is really famous, as I'm told, for having both sides be somewhat sympathetic in why their war is happening between the ogres and, the humans or whatever they're called in the fantasy land. I was kind of hoping for a little more from that with Discovery, that I would look at the Klingons and be like, I get it. Like, they have things they want to protect. You know what I mean? Like, as opposed to kind of turning to kind of this holy war type idea.
Well, I think what they're doing with the Klingons right now is they're not looking at the Klingons as one group.
Hmm.
They are really digging into the diversity of the Klingons by the albino Klingon, by a Klingon who, is sacrificing everything for his race, and the Klingon who will do anything to be the head of whatever happens. There's normally you see the Klingons, very cosmetic in terms of Klingons are this.
Right.
And you see that through Star Trek, sadly enough. And through Discovery, there's a little more diversity in this race that I've never seen before.
I think, yeah, that's a fair point in that they are presenting that diversity within characters. They're not just this generic alien. But we do see, a lot of strong differences between a Worf versus a Martok versus a Gowron versus a Duras versus a Kern, for example. like, those are five very distinct kinds of characters.
Or an Alexander.
Yes. But they're all identifiable as Klingons. I think definitely. We can all agree, that guy is definitely Klingon, but they're all very distinct. I like how they're tackling them as characters, but, with some commonalities as a species. But there is a distinct difference between what we're seeing with Volk and Laurel versus just every other time we encounter Klingons, they're just, like, stabbing the pilot to death, as we saw at the beginning.
And apparently, sexually assaulting Tyler, maybe?
Ash Tyler.
Seems to be.
Yes. but also just the other prison ship Klingons that kick the guy in the face.
Right.
That's kind of the demonization that we're seeing. To me, it gives them less, nuance if they're just portrayed as these, thugs.
Right, because we've seen, Lorca is kind of being held up as the very problematic captain, right? Like, he's the one we should be like, oh, he's dark and we aren't sure about this. He's looking a lot more sympathetic than a lot of the Klingons are.
I think that's a very good point. And, you understand why Lorca absolutely hates the Klingons.
Right.
So, but I think we are going
to
be...
It's hard to love them at this point.
Well, you say that, but, are you speaking as...
I'm speaking of the ones that say the Federation has encountered. You know what I mean? Volk and, Laurel are kind of off on the margins.
Yeah. So,
and they're the sympathetic ones.
Which, but I have to believe there are more sympathetic Klingons out there.
I look forward to meeting them.
Yeah. What if it comes around where we find out that Cole is like the most sympathetic Klingon of all?
I hope that's true.
Yeah.
Because I do like his face paint.
We haven't really talked about his face paint.
It's cool.
It does look like face paint, right?
Yeah, I think so. That or tattoos.
Is it a Chakotay callback?
Chakotay or a tattoo?
Does he wake up every morning and just like splash it on his face?
Will we get an episode like Tattoo, where it's an entire episode about the origin of Cole's face paint?
I can't wait, guys. The other thing I think a lot of people will be talking about this week, though, is the decision to drop not one, but two F-bombs in Star Trek, which we've never heard before.
Can we just maybe do a bit of history on swearing in Star Trek? Because
I'll double dumbass on you, Ken.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. And didn't Data swear in one of the TNG movies?
Yeah, yes. He said, oh, shit.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Cover your ears, kids. So, does... Okay. I'm not somebody who has any problem watching shows or movies with swearing, but does this make it problematic to introduce this in this Star Trek universe?
It feels like...
Does it feel wedged in? Does it feel unnatural?
It feels like they're reaching for that MA rating to sell it as adult content. Like, to me, I guess if you're going to put it in the mouth of a character, Tilly makes as much sense as anyone because she doesn't really have a filter. But, I mean, I don't know. Like,
to me, it just felt unnecessary.
Well, it feels like they want it to be a big, like, comedy moment. And I don't really find it funny.
Yeah, did any of us laugh?
No.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, you did.
We had to pause and, you know, Jesse had to, you know, console himself when it was over. He was laughing so hard.
No, I was surprised I was the only one laughing. I looked over and they're not laughing.
Yeah.
Just taking notes.
We were like grim-faced.
But, I mean, is this just generating controversy just for the sake of it? Does it really add any sort of value?
I think it's going to generate controversy.
Yep.
I don't know that it added any value. It was a comedic beat for me because I didn't care. I don't care if you cuss in Star Trek. I just want... I want a resolution to something in an episode.
Well, here's a question. Was this a character beat that maybe means something? Like, you know, we're seeing, like, Tilly sort of really expressing herself in excitement. Like, did this mean something to the character, maybe?
I think, to me, what it meant was that... she's getting more comfortable in her own skin, especially with Michael, where she was scared of death of Michael. And now she's like, we need to talk. So there's something there. And I don't know if it's going to mean anything or not.
I will say one thing I kind of liked about this moment. I can't say I want to see a character drop the F-bomb. Like, I don't really care. But it does feel kind of out of place in like the world of Star Trek, which has had 700-something episodes to establish sort of a vocabulary of how characters would conduct themselves in Starfleet.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the idea, at least, that Stamets kind of gives it a look, and then he's kind of like on board, like, no, this is that awesome. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I like that it has a moment of camaraderie with the characters, and I think in an episode, and we didn't really acknowledge this up top, like, it has a ton of character moments that we haven't really seen so far. A lot of it's been very, you know, plot-oriented or action-oriented. This was an episode that took a lot of breaks to have characters interact with one another and to let us see how they behave. You know, this is what a lot of fans have been complaining about so far, is the lack of moments with characters talking.
But
this is at least one of them. I'm not going to say it's my favorite, but it is a moment of bonding between two characters who previously have not really, I don't think, acknowledged each other at all.
But I still wish that we just had more time to breathe, you know, within the show. We haven't really had time to breathe with these characters. It's just been this kind of propulsive sort of narrative that we've been following. You know, there's no excursions to watch community theater in 10 forward like we get with Next Generation.
But are you going to get that with 15 episodes as opposed to 26 or 24?
I would like to. Like, why not?
I mean, DS9 would work in, like, you know, take me out to the holosuite in, during the Dominion War.
But they had enough episodes to do that with.
Yeah, that is a good point, you know, because there was a lot more episodes in Deep Space Nine's seventh season than what Discovery has. But
I don't think that's stopping them from taking 5 minutes in just any given episode to, like, just breathe with the characters. I don't think it has to be like these comedic sorts of, you know, like I said as an example, moments where you're doing community theater or anything like that. But it just feels like we are not hanging out with the crew so much like we got with Next Generation or Deep Space Nine.
Can you hang out with the crew in 5 minutes?
Well, we did all the time in Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Next Generation. Even Voyager, we had like opera hour with the EMH.
You did in an episode, but you had a span of 26 episodes.
But I think you could have a 2-hour season. Like 2 episodes in one season, you can still take 5 minutes to breathe with the crew. Where you don't need this propulsive narrative like nonstop.
I would even settle for like a few minutes at the start of the episode where the characters are just hanging out. You know what I mean? Like, we get the sense that when they're off duty, they're actually, you know, I don't know, having movie night or something. I mean, I don't know if they're doing that in wartime, but you know what I mean? Even soldiers in World War II had, like, USO days or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, they were watching...
We need Bob Hope in Star Trek Discovery.
Who's the equivalent of Bob Hope in the future?
Kid Rock. We need Kid Rock to come out.
Bob to bang, to bang. Yeah, like hologram Kid Rock. I mean, holograms are all the rage now. Imagine by then, you know. We just saw, like, Blade Runner, which had Elvis Presley as a hologram. Who knows who they're watching in? Kid Rock?
So, I know we're talking about sacrifice, but can I... Yeah. I have to talk about the holograms.
Yeah.
I still don't... I'm not comfortable with it. And I still don't understand how the holograms fits into this universe where we didn't see them until DS9, late on DS9.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with it. They've established as kind of a visual reboot. There's so many other things, you know, like just look at the look of the Shenzhou or the Discovery versus other ships at that time. Just look at the shapes of their nacelles and how much more streamlined these ships are. I've just kind of gone with it. Like, it's a very much like how, you know, I mean, we have different kinds of consoles versus what we had on the original series, you know?
Yeah, and we did see on Enterprise, like, there was the Zindi had the hologram, you know, Darth Sidious. Or not the Zindi, the Sulaban.
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah, holograms existed back then.
Maybe they picked up some Sulaban tech that, you know, they'll lose before Kirk comes onto the Enterprise.
Maybe we'll find out in the series finale that hologram technology is going wrong and it's all going to be banned.
Harry Mudd, like, corrupts it all.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so far, we know that the spore drive isn't going to be around.
Doesn't seem like
it. I don't know. You know, so I'm okay with that. And I know you can't start a TV series in 2017 and not have something to be visually pleasing to the new viewers you're trying to get. It just bugs me a little bit.
Well, why don't we bring up something that we heard at the convention here in San Francisco. Michael Dorn was talking about how he had meetings with Brian Fuller. Brian Fuller, well, back when he was still showrunner, wanted Dorn on the show and was showing Dorn his like renderings of the new look of the Klingons. Dorn said they actually look quite a bit different than what we see on screen in Discovery. He said Fuller had a far more inventive look for them. They were going to have smoother heads. I don't exactly know what that means. This is just Dorn's words, but smoother heads and CG eyes as well. So I think Fuller, if Fuller was still going to be running the series, I don't know if we would have had holograms. I don't know if we would have had uniforms that look the way they do. Because remember, Fuller was posting pictures with like those kind of, you know, classic colors as uniforms with turtlenecks and everything on his Twitter account.
Oh yeah, I forgot about those.
Yes. So like this was definitely like a very different, like there's a reason why Discovery got delayed and Fuller is no longer with the series as well. And I think it's kind of reflective, and maybe my guess is Fuller wanted more of a throwback sort of style that honors what came before it while, you know, pushing things forward to a certain degree. I don't think he really quite imagined this kind of revamped Battlestar Galactica sort of look that we're having here.
And that is true, but I also think that they are getting the throwbacks to what came before, especially when they came with... Saru's asking for the list of best captains.
Okay, can we talk about this list?
Yes.
Well, was it strange he asked for the most decorated captains of all time, and we had every single captain we've heard of. It was Captain Robert April, who we knew as the first commander of the Enterprise. We also had one Matt Decker, who we know from the Doomsday Machine.
Yeah, that went well.
That went well. We also had one, Christopher Pike. Yep. Presumably the second captain, immediately to follow Robert April.
We had Jonathan Archer.
We had Jonathan Archer, another guy that we knew. So did it take about 100 years to get any good captains to, you know, make it onto this list? Because all these captains that I've mentioned, also Giorgio, she was also on this list. So that's four contemporary captains and then one guy who served 100 years ago. Those are the five most decorated captains in all of Starfleet.
So it would appear.
Yeah, and do you? And I got the sense with Shenzhou and Giorgio that that was not the premier, you know, ship of the fleet. Like I thought it was more of kind of a second rung, sort of like.
No, but there's history we don't know there about Giorgio yet, and because remember she kept saying, you know, I have been through a lot of battles and a lot of wars. And, you know, Sarek brought you to me because I still have hope. There's stuff we don't know about Giorgio, and I don't think it's stuff that happened on the Shenzhou. I think there's something else there we don't know yet.
I hope so, because, you know, she said, like, oh, it's an old ship, and it's just like the science vessel, where you're like, okay. And then she's on the list with, like, you know, April and Pike and what have you. I mean, I'm not against Giorgio being among the greats. I just don't really understand how she wound up on the Shenzhou.
Among the most decorated captains of all time in
like
Starfleet.
Like, Archer wrote the book on Starfleet.
Yes. understand why the guys that are on the Enterprise, which is not necessarily the flagship. I know that D was the flagship, but I don't think the Constitution class was, but it was a big deal to be captain of the Enterprise. I understand why they're there.
Yes.
Decker had been set up by the time we get to Doomsday Machine as a big deal.
Yeah.
I just didn't get the sense that Giorgio was within that tier. And I like that about her.
You mean you didn't get that within the first two episodes?
I mean, I
don't. No, she was on like a kind of a rundown ship.
Yeah.
The Shenzhou was a rundown ship.
Yeah, I agree.
And yeah, I mean, and then there's the issue just too, because, you know, they're putting Giorgio on a list of like six or whatever, five or six. We hear about all these other characters in the future, just knowing the canon. So it always kind of annoys me because it's like, why did Giorgio get dropped from the list, essentially, that characters would mention? And I know that's an issue of a prequel problem, mm-hmm. right? Of course they're not going to go and digitally change all the future Star Trek episodes to acknowledge Giorgio. But it's the sort of thing that you're just like, oh, like, because then it gives you the sense of, like, why'd they drop her from the list?
I may have an explanation, though.
Yes.
Okay. The computer, knowing that it was Saru who is asking for this list, maybe the computer wanted Saru to feel better about himself, saying like, yeah, you're serving underneath one of the best, baby. You know, I think it was mostly just to massage Saru's very, very fragile ego, as we found out later in the episode.
But let me ask you something that I thought about this episode. I didn't, like, there's things I don't get and I'm okay with, but when he says, why would the computer ask, why are you looking for this list? What was that about?
I think it wanted to better figure out what to do with this list, right?
I guess, yeah.
So, I'm a little... Was it like a therapy computer?
Maybe. Maybe slightly. I mean, we would often see the computer would act in some ways that maybe weren't the most believable from the point of view of where we are at this point in time of technology. But let's... You know what? We're talking about Saru. What do you guys think about this episode for Saru? Because This might be the episode we've seen the most of that character, and the most about his sort of internal struggle.
I felt very mixed about this because it doesn't seem as if Saru is necessarily command ready. He's dealing with the issue where people are undermining his authority, but I don't think he's handling it as well as, say, Data did in what was the episode in which Worf was second in command to Data, and they had a lot of problems working with each other. I think it was one of the two-parters. Cam, was it? It was not Redemption.
It wasn't Unification, was it?
Yeah, it was Unification.
It was Unification. Yeah, exactly.
I think Data handled it far better than Saru did.
But Spock did not handle being in charge well when he was, you know, in the Galileo 7. So there is a precedent for amazing first officer characters to not handle being in charge well.
It's a learning experience for Saru.
Yeah, and think about the learning experience. He's sharing that with Burnham.
Who he really does not trust.
Yes.
He just does not trust her.
Did they just within 44 minutes become the best of friends? Because that's what it looked like to me.
I don't think so. I really don't think so.
He got a telescope out of it.
That's true.
Yeah. But I think he still has a long ways to go with her. And let's talk about that conversation that I think was very important that they had, where Saru said he was very jealous of what Burnham had with Giorgio, in that she got to learn everything she could from Giorgio. The idea was Burnham would get her own command and Saru would move up and be able to learn everything he could from Giorgio. That was taken away from him, and I can understand why he feels that maybe he's not ready to be an acting captain, because he did not have the tutelage of the same kind of tutelage that Burnham had under Giorgio. I thought that was a very fascinating kind of scene, and I actually want more of those kinds of scenes going forward in Discovery. This seemed more like kind of a hangout scene than a lot of the other things that we've been having.
I mean, one thing is, you know, we've seen throughout the series that the Saru is hypersensitive, both you know, as a species that is preyed upon, but emotionally too, he's very sensitive, and we can see that there's always that sense of threat, and like he sees Burnham as a threat. Not only, I think, you know, to maybe what she could bring to the ship, but also what she could do to him, because I mean, I think we're seeing that. Of all the people, he's very worried about having her around, and I think it's because of the sense that she threatens his position. And I kind of like this from a character, because if you look at the point of view of a species that is always being preyed upon, how easy is it for that species to develop trust with someone else?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And especially when it's been undermined the way that Burnham did with Giorgio.
Yes.
Well, and when I think of this scene that they had as well, I think that it started with her saying, "Are you afraid of me?"
Yeah.
And like she misunderstood his motivations, because he said, "I'm not afraid of you. I'm jealous and I'm mad and I'm angry because you took stuff away from me." And now she again has to deal with, what the hell did I do now?
Although, recall, before she came onto the bridge at the beginning, his threat ganglia did expand.
Yes, yes.
So, but by the end of it, we didn't see his threat ganglia expanding as she approached him.
Again, I like that, you know, I think it was last week I talked about how I like the idea of two, you know, highly trained, competent professionals who maybe don't necessarily like each other, but respect one another. And, you know, so far that seems to be the way we're going with these two. You know, who knows, maybe six seasons from now they're the best of friends and they're hanging out on, you know, one of the early holodecks or something like that. Who knows, right? But we're going to Risa together. Who knows? But I like the sense that, you know, that Saru maybe realizes that Burnham, as much as he has issues with her, maybe she's the only one he can talk to in a certain sense, because she understands maybe where he's coming from. Like, Saru's probably not going to have this talk with Lorca.
And I think the other thing that you're kind of touching upon here is, do you believe if Discovery's on for 7 years that Burnham and Saru are going to have their same relationship, you know, 7 years from now as we're experiencing here in season one? I think that there's going to be a lot of evolution into where they are, and it's going to be fun to go back to, like, I don't know, episode 3, and just see how much Saru really does not care for Burnham's presence aboard the Discovery.
I'm actually a bit concerned of how fast the relationships are going, because I'm so used to the 7 seasons, and you see those relationships change over time. But I'm thinking about, okay, so within this one episode, there's this, like, we're going to start to work together with Saru. And then there's a Stamets and Burnham moment that was almost the same. Remember, that relationship started with, why the heck are you in my lab? And now they're working together to save this tardigrade?
Right, in one episode, yeah.
So I'm a little concerned about how fast. I love it. I'm just concerned about, do we have enough to build this out the way the other Star Trek series?
But I think they can keep introducing conflict between the characters, and which I know that's going to be another issue that a lot of fans are going to have, is because I don't think conflict is going anywhere when it comes to how they want to write these shows. And that was the big part of TNG, where we would never have scenes like what we experienced tonight, where you literally have Saru like kind of like yelling at Burnham and Stamets, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with that. I think, you know, I read a review, I think it was over at Birth Movies Death, that I thought was well written and had a good insight in the sense, you know, they liked last week's episode. They were talking about, you know, they liked a lot of where the episode was going in the series so far, but they felt the show was a little too mean in its conflict. And I think I get the sense of that where, you know, when we would see, say, characters on Deep Space Nine get into fights, there was always the sense that, like, they would rise above it and they'd be like, okay, you know what? You know, we, you know, like each other, we respect one another. We haven't gotten to that point yet in Discovery where I feel, like, when I see characters kind of being snide to one another or getting into disagreements, I'm like, oh, they don't like each other. Like, you know, it's not a sense of, like, look, you know, Starfleet were like elevated above sort of those human emotions, you know, we can see past it. I don't get that sense. I still feel like they're squabbling a little more, and it's not even kind of like the way where, like, you know, Bones and Spock are kind of going at each other, but, you know, there's like kind of a jab at each other, a joking jab, and, you know, they'll be hanging out with Kirk by the end of the episode. Do you guys, I don't know, how do you guys feel about the idea of sort of these arguments being found in sort of a way where there's more anger and sort of negative emotion than philosophical difference?
I believe these arguments are personality conflicts and personalities that are forced together and don't know how to work with each other quite yet. And I think that's, I'm okay with that.
Does that fit within the Trek universe as we know it? Is that what you're getting at, Cam?
Yeah.
Like, whether it's congruent with the established kind of rules or parameters of the universe as is?
It wouldn't, but when I look back at DS9, which was probably one of the other ones that had significant war episodes, those people had some burn-in time to get to know each other before that war happened. These people were thrown together as the war started, and they not only have to figure out each other's personalities, but do it while keeping the Federation or Starfleet safe.
Well, I think that's a very good point, is because we do get some background that Lorca had a previous command up until the war, and that was interesting. We also find out, I don't know, because I would have assumed that somebody like Landry had maybe served with him for years.
Yeah.
Apparently not. Just in the last 6 months. And that was it.
Lorca's that charismatic.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe some other little details that we find out. A crew complement of 134. Does that seem like a tiny ship to you guys?
It seems very tiny when an episode before they said we can run 300 multitanious...
Simultaneous
experiments at the same time. So, like, you would need at least 300 people to do that.
But this is a... Just think about how this is kind of the era where you had about 428 people serving aboard the USS Enterprise. Is Discovery meant to be, like, a considerably, like, just size-wise, a much smaller vessel?
Well, think about it. No one's living in the saucer section.
Well.
Aren't they?
I don't know.
The way it spins and stuff, you think people live in there?
Yeah, it'd be a real pain in the butt to get to the mess hall. You're like, I gotta wait. It's still spinning.
Yeah, I just like
now to imagine... Now I know why they need a black alert.
I just like to imagine someone's, like, asleep and the whole thing's spinning, like, tossed across the room.
Just wake up hungover every morning.
That'd be pretty great.
But honestly, you know, now that we're seeing more of the ship, I have to think there's no one habitating in that area, especially with the two cylinders.
I think typically on ships, all the crew, the majority of crew quarters are in the saucer sections, right? That was established on Next Gen, I believe Voyager as well. So are they all in the... Okay, so there's the outer ring, an inner ring, and then the central core. Maybe they're all in the inner ring. I don't know. That's my best guess as to where the crews are chilling. A few other little things I don't want mine getting out there. Cam, you and I discussed this off the air, but one of the things that I'm finding very strange is I like the fact that we have a very diverse crew.
Yeah.
Although it seems that every person of color, except for one, the helmswoman, I don't want to mess up her last name. First name is Joanna. But everyone but her, who is a person of color, they all have European names. Right. So we're introduced to Reese, who is a man of East Asian descent. Landry was a woman of South Asian descent. Ash Tyler, a man, I'm presumably of Middle Eastern descent. Giorgio, a woman of East Asian descent once again. These are all European names, but they're people of color, and I'm just like, why can't you have anybody with, like, a name, like, you know, I'm not gonna do some generic ethnic names, I'll get myself in trouble, but what, isn't that a little, like, disconcerting, or I don't know, I'm just kind of like...
Well, you and I talked about this, the other day, and I kind of proposed... Not that this is a good excuse. It was obviously like maybe colorblind casting going in, but then that doesn't answer the question. Then why were all the characters given sort of European names off the bat?
Yes.
I have no good answer for this.
And would it be offensive if you had somebody whose last name was, you know, an East Asian name, but it's played by somebody who's like obviously of Irish descent.
Right.
It's like, what, you couldn't hire somebody? Because we've had this discussion in Hollywood about the whitewashing of all these characters. So what if you have, like, an Irishman playing somebody whose last name is, like, Chang?
Right.
Like, that's...
That would be problematic.
That's going to be problematic, well,
didn't
right?
Christopher Plummer play a character named Chang?
That's true, yes.
Well, and, you know, the strange thing about that, too, you've got Lorca, who's Jason Isaacs, who's... What is he? What's his nationality?
Oh, the character or the actor?
The actor.
He's British.
He's British, playing someone like Trip Tucker's uncle. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't understand what's going on there either. So, it's just, I'm just...
Well, like, Gabriel Lorca sounds like a Spanish name. Yeah. So, it's kind of like... That's one more example. I don't know. It's just kind of... It leaves him going, huh, a lot.
Maybe if they'd taken sort of more of like... Did you ever see the movie The Time Machine? The adaptation?
Oh,
the
modern Guy Pearce?
Yes.
Yeah. You remember how all like the characters of that world had, you know, darker skin because it was years of, you know, breeding and what have you, interracial relationships, et cetera, et cetera. But this isn't doing that. There's a lot of like, you know, like Jason Isaacs does not look, right. You know, like a mixed heritage.
Well,
and
there's the one, I don't know what kind of officer he is on deck, but the one... he's obviously a white guy.
Oh, right.
Milton Richter.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yes. But he doesn't do anything. All his scenes, he's just turning around.
I'm okay with that. He does it well enough. Can we talk about Stamets? Because this was a big episode for Stamets as well as Dr. Culber, who, I'm liking Dr. Culber. How are you guys feeling?
Well, I'm a little confused. Yeah, I'm liking him, but didn't he say that he had to go help the CMO with an Andorian tonsillitis surgery?
I think he made that up.
Okay, but isn't... No, but what I'm getting at, though, is he not the CMO?
Oh.
That's a good one.
Like, I was very confused by that, because he's also a lieutenant commander, so it tells me that he's a high-ranking doctor. They keep going to him, but he says, I have to go help the CMO, which presumably stands for Chief Medical Officer... I have to go help the CMO with an Andorian tonsillitis.
The CMO died shortly after.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine.
Problem solved.
Well, the other problem is I haven't seen an Andorian yet, so...
Yeah, that's true enough.
But you bring up a good point. Like, I'm digging Dr. Culber.
This was the first episode we really got to see him be a character. You know, and I like that he, you know, is willing to take the side of even someone controversial like Burnham, because he's going to go, you know what, yes, medically, this is the right decision. I'm on her side. Let's go talk to the powers that be. You know, it's not like, oh, I can't really align with this person. You know what I mean? Like, it's putting the needs of, you know, the medical profession ahead of egos and, you know, Starfleet protocol.
It's a Hippocratic oath.
Yeah.
Stepping in. And I think in that scene, one of my thoughts was, Saru knows he's not going to go in for, you know, getting Ripper messed up again. So what does he do? He turns to the other guy because he doesn't have the Hippocratic Oath to go by. And I thought that was interesting. I thought that was a character moment for Saru. You don't see very often with him yet, which is quick thinking on his feet. I just have to believe he did that on purpose.
And I do appreciate Stamets' way of... countermining or undermining that order by going ahead and just injecting himself with the tardigrade serum.
Not surprised at all, because he wanted to, like, you know, communicate with his mushrooms last week or something.
Yeah, I know. I figured, like, he would have been the first one to volunteer for this little experiment, so it didn't surprise me there. Guys, Klingons, did you ever imagine them torturing people? Is torture something that Klingons would do? To me, I just pictured them as they would kill you.
So I got a Cardassian vibe off of today's episode.
Yeah, you know what? That's a good call. Like, yeah, chain of command. Yeah.
You know, and when I saw three lights, I'm like, oh, maybe there should be four. You know, just and with the eyes thing, I'm like, this is very Cardassian. Isn't that usually where you see that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so far, yes. We haven't seen a lot of torture in Star Trek. I mean... It makes sense that if, the, you know, in a time of war, you might do that to your enemy. It ties into, like, you know, just the horrible sides of war. But, again, you know, it's the issue of, like, you know, we're making the Starfleet members far more sympathetic because the Starfleet people aren't torturing anyone yet. You know, unless you count Ripper, who...
Yeah.
That one's more of a ignorance in a lot of ways. It's not being done as an intentional, you know, torture this creature sort of thing.
But maybe we can just brush it off with the prison ship captain. She says she's from a house of spies. Maybe that's their thing. Maybe there's different levels of houses, and they're like, okay, well, we as honorable Klingons aren't going to do that, but we have a house that might be willing to do something like that.
And there's, again, you know, Klingons who aren't doing what you think Klingons do, right? Because they're very different Klingons, well, different traits to the Klingons that we haven't seen yet. And maybe, I mean, I didn't know Klingons ate people.
Very true. Very true. I mean, I am waiting for us to meet sort of like the Klingon, you know, like a Gorkon or a, you know, a Martok or, you know, a Klingon who has a certain amount of nobility and it doesn't feel like they're just kind of playing villains.
It's more like a rational actor.
Yes, yes. Someone who maybe wants to talk to Starfleet or is, you know, not happy with the fact that they're at war but is bound by duty to take part in it. You know, just a little more complication to how they feel about the war.
So, let me ask you about the war.
Mm.
So, we have 24 houses that T'Kuvma tried to get together. We saw some of them go, no, I'm not going to listen to this. So, who's really at war?
No, they all did rally behind. Like, all 24 of the premier, I guess the high houses, they did rally behind T'Kuvma's cause after he lit the torch, or the beacon, I suppose, and they had the Battle of the Binary Stars.
So what about that scene where, you know, there were houses that said, I want to hear more, and some just, like, their
holograms went away? It was established after the Battle of the Binary Stars, all 24 houses said, okay, yeah, we're in it. We're going to go to war.
Okay.
Yeah. Guys, we didn't really say off the top. What do you think of this episode?
No, I think that's a very good question. to me, it seems kind of what we had last week in that, you know, more of a setting the chess pieces in place for what's going to follow up. There's moments in it that I liked, but as a whole, I felt like this is more of kind of a, not a filler episode, but it's not going to be one of those big memorable episodes that is going to be one of the highlights of season one, I think.
What do you think, Jesse?
I really enjoyed this episode, and because I'm approaching this from a holistic view. I'm not looking at it. Tonight's the first night I actually saw an episode and took notes. I don't usually do that. I just enjoy the whole experience, and then I'll watch it again and try to see what I gain from it. But I'm really excited I did this, because I've been listening to you guys do this, and I wanted to get there, you know. But this episode, beginning to end, it's a different type of Star Trek, but I'm still getting the Star Trek vibe. What I don't like is that we're in for a long ride. Like, the resolutions are very short and are very not a whole situation, just a thing. And at least we're getting that. But I still have no idea what's going on. Or I can't even predict what's going on with this series.
Yeah, I mean, that's not the issue for me. It's just... It feels more like it's, correct. Like, it's one chapter of a greater puzzle, but or a greater novel, but there just seems to be something kind of missing from what we got from those more episodic adventures of Star Trek, where it's going to stand out.
Well, it was like there was more, when an episode ended, there was like a satisfaction. You're like, even if it's an episode you don't like, you're like, okay, you know, like, that's a complete story for me to think about, you know, for the next week before we get to the next story. With this, I'm kind of like, good, cool, on to the next, like, what's going to happen next? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you don't get to kind of bask in, you know, sort of the arc of the episode. You know, I guess, you know, again, the standalone element of this, you know, installment was, you know, Lorca being kidnapped and then escaping. I kind of like the first week we saw Ripper, I felt like that was the weaker aspect of the episode. We've talked about Harry Mudd being problematic. I thought Rainn Wilson did a fantastic job in this character of doing something different and yet recognizable with a character that fans know very well.
Overall, five episodes in, Cam, where do you think you would place this?
I would put this about mid-tier, because what I liked about this episode was the character stuff. Like, I love the talks between Saru and Burnham. I love the moments between, you know, Culber and Stamets. You know, like, I liked watching these characters talk because I felt like this early into the series, it actually felt like a novelty to just have a scene where two characters were just talking about a situation, you know, and trying to decide if they're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. I liked Saru being stubborn and defiant, you know, against, you know, these people who are potentially rising up. And I understand why he's frustrated by someone like Burnham, because already she's got people kind of on her side. And he's seen how bad that can go before. So, you know, I can understand why people are frustrated. You know, I see online a lot about how, you know, the serialization is kind of taking away from sort of the sense of what they're watching. I totally get it, and I often feel the same way. But I will say, like, as I'm getting further into it, the stuff that I was worried about, I think, you know, right off the top, I was worried about, you know, and this was a, you know, the first two episodes, we were with the Shenzo crew, so we didn't get attached to anyone, really. But I like that as we're going, I'm getting more and more invested in the characters. I will say, like, you know, Ash Tyler left almost no impact on me in this episode. I'm hoping, you know, like some of the others, though, I grow to like him in the next few episodes. And I think the show is doing a fairly good job in, you know, establishing all of the characters' personalities. Whereas, you know, a lot of the series we love didn't give even the beloved characters that much to do. You know, Uhura never got, like, big episodes, you know, not really, in the original series. Or, you know, members of, you know, the TNG crew were often ignored, especially through the first, second season. So, you know, Discovery isn't falling into that trap, which I appreciate. But I would like, you know, as we kind of said, you know, a little more satisfaction at the end of an episode of kind of like, wow, you know, even if it is continued, just a more of a sense of, like, finality to the arc of that hour.
We're officially 1/3 of the way through season one. Does it feel like we're at the end of the first act? Is that...
I don't feel that way at all. I feel like... I don't even know that they're acts at this point. You know, and I'm five episodes in. Specifically for me, I'm five episodes in, and I've changed my mind on Lorca four times. And this last time, what got me was him leaving Harry Mudd in jail, in a prison, in a Klingon jail where they torture people.
Well, would Picard ever do that?
No, because it's a Federation citizen, whether you like him or not. You know, you've got to save him.
But and Kirk wouldn't do that, even though Kirk hates him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I totally get it. But, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing that you go back and forth on Lorca. I think that's by design, and that he's, you know, been presented as a warmonger who we're going to go back and forth on, which I kind of would prefer as opposed to someone who I'm like, this guy's a bastard. Get rid of him, you know, for the full, you know, season one or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I'm on board. I'm liking that the show is interested in character. I would say I don't care about the war yet in the way that I did, like, with the DS9, say, invasion arc or what have you. Like, I don't feel as sucked into the overall war.
Well, I think the big difference there is you had 5 years to get to know these characters, and then you put them in this entirely different situation, a very dynamic situation, whereas this, you're just being introduced to these characters within the context of this war. You don't necessarily know how they were before, save for Burnham and Saru.
Right. No, that's a very good point, yeah.
Guys, just two final thoughts, maybe before we wrap up here, but was it weird that Lorca and Tyler, they're sitting down in the Raider when they're transported, and then when they're transported onto the pad, well, Lorca's standing up? That was weird.
He, like, jumped up out of his seat at the last moment.
He wanted to look good. The other thought, I love this shout-out when Saru went to the quarters of Burnham, and she hears the chime and says, come. That was a nice shout-out to one Captain Picard.
Yeah, I like that, too. I mean, that is basically saying, like, I'm going to be a captain one day. Look out.
And I think, for me, the oddest thing was I didn't feel like this episode ended. I'm very confused by what I saw in the mirror.
What, the sonic toothbrushes?
You know, when I it was strange, but no, when Stamets is looking at himself and he's still in the mirror.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see next week, right? You know, Ripper's out of the way now, so I guess this is the next, you know, story we're going to see over, like, what, two episodes before it's resolved. Yeah. And then we're on to the next thing. So, it's, you know, I don't know that the Spore Drive is working maybe as well as it should, but it's going to places we haven't seen before. So I'll give it that. And, you know, I will say I thought, you know, the farewell to Ripper was kind of touching. I thought that worked. You know, you compared in your blog last week to Devil in the Dark. Devil in the Dark sort of had a poignant ending with the Horta. I thought this did a good job of sending the Ripper off in style.
Right? I think so.
You know, with a nice like Wall-E style space dance. Yeah. So
guys, why don't we just briefly touch upon the Star Trek convention that we're at here in San Francisco. We had 2 days of stars galore, lots of costumes and people we got to meet and hang out with. Guys, a highlight for you, Jesse.
The highlight for me, it's not one particular thing, but it's I'm not stressed to go to pick a panel or miss a panel. I love that I've gotten to more panels these past couple days than I have ever in you know 5 days in Vegas, and I think it's because it's got to be the distance. It doesn't take me 15 minutes to go to my room and go see a panel, and the panels are not. I don't know. It just feels like here they're not as they're a little more flexible,
right?
And they're not as rigid, and you know, and they're a lot more freeform. So I'm enjoying them a little.
I think it's one of the benefits that you get from instead of panels with five people, it's just like a one-on-one sort of Q&A format. So you get a lot more time with individual actors, and I think that's a great benefit that we have at the smaller cons versus a big convention like Las Vegas, which is an entirely different animal, has its plus and minuses.
Yeah, I mean, you go to Vegas and you get, like, the group panels. You know, here's the entire Voyager cast on stage, which is awesome. It's a lot of fun. But you don't get, you know, to hear what, like, say, Tim Russ has to say about Tuvok's motivation in a random episode. You right. know, that's the kind of stuff I like. And, you know, like, I was, my highlight personally was honestly, I got to ask Robert Duncan McNeil about featuring in Masters of the Universe, the 1987 He-Man movie. And he, I'm sure he's been asked about it before, but I don't think he gets asked about it a lot. And so he just, like, was peppering off all these sort of random anecdotes about shooting it, you know, about Dolph Lundgren and sort of the atmosphere on set. You know,
What did he keep saying, Cam?
It was the 80s.
Yes.
And, you know, talking about, you know, Courtney taking Courtney Cox to a car show and she bought, you know, like a Mustang or something. And
it was a Mercedes.
Mercedes, and saying, you know, he wished he had gotten an action figure. There was just, like, a lot of fun stuff. And, again, I got to ask also Robert Picardo about being Gremlins 2 and making out with the female gremlin. He talked about how it was a butt puppet that he had to actually operate himself with a fake arm. Just details like that you're not going to hear on a group panel in Vegas.
Just to clarify, a butt puppet in that Robert Picardo's hand would go up the butt of the puppet,
right?
And that's how he would operate it.
And I have to props to Cam for the only person who asked a question that got the word butt to come out of
it. very true.
My highlight had to be John Billingsley. He said, guys, I want to raise awareness about people with audiovisual inputs disabilities. And so he said, come ask me the most embarrassing questions you can. We'll have a panel of judges to judge the most embarrassing questions. And whoever wins gets to throw a pie in my face. It was quite the hour-long Q&A that we had with John Billingsley. So I went up there, gave him some praise for a recent performance I saw him in the movie 20th Century Women. And then I asked him this question. You helped me out with it, Jesse, because, Cam, you and I, when we were in Seattle a couple years ago, we could not help but notice that he had been wearing the same clothes multiple days in a row.
Right.
And I knew that Jesse had encountered John Billingsley the day before, and I was like, Jesse, is he wearing the same clothes as he was last night? And you confirmed that he was. So
he was.
I went up to the mic, and I asked him, are those the same clothes you were wearing yesterday? Got a good laugh out of the crowd. I ended up coming in second place, and I actually won a poem that John Billingsley had actually penned for this Q&A specifically. He even signed it and drew a little picture of himself on it. Overall, Cam, what did you make of John Billingsley letting somebody pie him in the face?
The photo alone was worth it. If you go find, I think it's John Billingsley 20 on Instagram, you can see the photo. It's amazing. But just, you know, we were watching John Billingsley rip off his shirt, pull his shorts up to, like, his nipples, and then get hit in the face with whipped cream pie. Listener at home, think about another Star Trek star who might do that.
Like, Cam and I debated this. There's no one. There is no other Star Trek star who would do it. It's like, John Billingsley is a force to be reckoned with at these conventions. Like, he's a total blast. And we actually got to go hang out with him later on in the evening. Jesse, you got friends involved with the Gays in Space yep. charity. You got us a hookup over there. Then we dropped in for some drinks. And John Billingsley, Robert Picardo, Hannah Hatte, they all showed up, and Cam, you and I got some awesome photos with both Hannah Hatte and one John Billingsley. It was a pretty fun night.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you know, Jesse, what was your highlight of that event?
I've got to think about this. I think the highlight of that event was just seeing how much fun everyone was having. So it's the first event that I've had to help with.
Anything specific jump out to you? Well, if somebody just asked you for a specific memory, what jumps out to you right now?
The specific memory would be at the end. So at the end, you know, we're about 45 minutes over time and the bar wants us to leave. So that was exciting.
Yeah, I had the bartender tell me to take off my hat. I was like, what? And then I just walked away and ignored him. And it's just like...
Let's just say the bartender is not associated with Gaze in Space.
No,
it wasn't. At the end, everyone was called in to send them off. And Gaze in Space is three A's in Gaze and three A's in Space. And they do it like the pigs in space. So it's Gaze in Space. And the fact that everybody knew it was kind of fun. The other highlight had to be people who came in, just who lived in the town, didn't know why we were there. And So there were a lot of good people watching at the door.
Yeah, definitely.
Did they pay the cover to get in, though?
No.
Oh, damn you.
But who knows? Maybe they will next time, right? Yeah. Okay, so before we sign off, there's no Ortonville this week.
Because we're in transit on our way from Vancouver to San Francisco, so I did not get a chance to watch this week's episode of Orville. So maybe we'll do a double header of the Ortonville report next week as well, once I catch up to the show. But we did get to hear from Robert Duncan McNeil and Jonathan Frakes. They all have high praises for Seth MacFarlane and what he's doing on the Orville.
Yeah, Orville was very popular with a lot of the congoers this weekend. So.
It seemed more popular than Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, maybe we should be doing Orville episodes every week instead. But, we had some feedback on last week's episode from our foreign correspondent, Scott Hardy. But, you know, I just want to say to everyone who is commenting on our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod, there was some great conversations going on this week. Guys, like, we're really appreciating everything you're bringing to this. You know, we are just two perspectives, three in this case with Jesse here. But, you know, we are loving hearing what you guys have to say because you're bringing up points that we don't necessarily, you know, they're not off the top of our heads when we're recording these episodes. And it just enriches the whole experience of watching Discovery for me and I think, you know, hopefully for all of you at home as well who are chiming in. And, you know, I like that, you know, maybe a few exceptions. It's not just like hurling negativity and then, you know, checking off to the next Facebook board. We're actually getting some serious discussion, and just thanks to everyone who's doing that. But why don't we jump on over to what Scott Hardy had to say about the butcher's knife cares not for the lamb's cry.
Hey guys, Scott Hardy beaming in from London, England. Just want to give you my thoughts on episode 4 of Star Trek Discovery, The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. I really want to agree with Cam on this one. This felt like the most Star Trek episode so far. I was actually sort of moaning towards the beginning of the episode that I wasn't really enjoying it too much. And then I realized about halfway through I'd just been morality played. I thought, oh, this is Star Trek. I can get into this. A bit of a shame about Landry, I would say. And also, I wasn't a big fan of how Discovery sort of looped in itself with its spork drive. It seemed a bit Star Wars-y to me, but hey ho, beggars can't be choosers. As I say, I'm still excited to see where the series goes. Thanks guys, I'll catch you next time.
Well, Tyler, what do you think? I think Scott is a genius, obviously, out there in London, England. You know, it's nice to know that we have geniuses listening to this podcast.
He sounds like a Fandry too. And I do appreciate the fact that he turned morality play into a verb.
Yeah. You know, he already coined spork drive, so.
Spork.
So anyone at home, you know, if you would like to join Scott in kind of giving us your thoughts on Star Trek Discovery, we'd love to hear them. You can send voicemails in to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. And, you know, you can also, of course, reach us on the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We are doing our blogs again this week, even though we're on the road. We're going to try and pack them into our schedule. They may run a little bit later this week, but they will be happening. And, Tyler, what did you talk about last week? Because I think people should still check that out.
I went and compared The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry to Devil in the Dark. Of course, we had the Horta tardigrade sort of comparisons, but it took a weird turn in the blog in that I examine how ubiquitous the profession of mining seems to be in the 23rd and 24th centuries, where it's just bizarre all the connections you see to the world of mining. And I keep asking in the blog, why? You have the galaxy at your fingertips and you decide to devote your life to digging underground?
For free.
For free. Like, this is a new world, like a new way of exploring. And these are not, they don't have robots doing the digging. We literally see people in hard hats. It's like people literally mining. I'm just like, why would anybody do this? It makes no sense. There must have been some sort of robot rebellion that there's a reason why we can't get robots to do all the mining.
It's like the robot war in that Voyager episode, Prototype.
Oh, yeah. Cam, what did you write about?
Yeah, so I talked about the similarities between that episode and sort of the act of, you know, torturing Ripper for their own good and the movie Starship Troopers. And just the idea of, you know, whether war turns people into fascists. And, you know, it was the episode, when I watched it, it immediately just conjured up images of the brain bug being probed and prodded, you know, to try and win the war for the good guys as they cheer and, you know, rah, rah, rah. And we, you know, I got some very interesting conversation going with this blog, and I am very happy with the fact that, you know, people were a little polarized on how they felt. You know, some did agree that, you know, Starfleet was kind of flirting with very dangerous, you know, a very dangerous mindset. And then other people were kind of outraged at this comparison. So, you know, I think the blog post kind of did what I hoped it would do, and that it got people thinking about, you know, how is Starfleet behaving at this point? Is this acceptable? So, you know, we'll see what we do this week, and hopefully it's just as thought-provoking for both our blogs. So look for those at facebook.com/subspacepod. So next week we'll be back with the next Discovery episode, Laith. I don't know what that's about, but it sounds intriguing.
I think it's Greek. Is that the return of Giorgio then?
We can only hope.
All right.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vulcan Admiral, Smith.
Cam, was Spock not established as the first Vulcan in Starfleet? And now we have a Vulcan Admiral here?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. That's what I don't know. Like,
I was very confused by this introduction of this Admiral.
Yeah, because T'Pol was never a member of Starfleet.
She was commissioned on the ship.
Yeah.
But it's not like, and this is before, you know, the Federation. This is kind of a different version of Starfleet. I don't know. It's all very murky at this point.
Yeah, I have no idea. All
right.
But anyhow, where are you on Twitter, Tyler?
And you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in needs a 23rd century toothbrush.
And Jesse, where are you on Twitter?
I'm at Trekker Jesse. That's T-R-E-K-K-E-R underscore Jesse, J-E-S-S-E. E as in I'm excited that it's my ship, my way.
As in I'm excited?
We're going to let that one slide.
You should let it slide. Yeah, it'll be good. You'll get comments on it.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.